Okay, so just to end off really yesterday's discussion before I move on, just to end off the discussion about inflation, and so we derived yesterday that basically the slow roll limit was one where the kinetic term was much smaller than the potential, and the double dot derivative term was much smaller than the friction term. And this makes these equations somewhat straightforward now to solve, because that you can directly solve the Hubble constant in terms of the potential, and then rearranging this equation, you've just got an equation for phi dot in terms of phi itself, and Planck square root of V of phi. Or it's actually a nicer way to write this equation is to invert it and really say that this is an equation for the time as a function of phi, because it's minus square root of 3 square root of V over V comma phi and M Planck. And the point is then everything on the right-hand side is just some function of phi, and I can just integrate it up to get the time. So it's an integration constant. The time is given by minus integral from some initial value of phi to the value of phi at t times square root of 3 root V over V comma phi and Planck. That's still a bit of a nasty formula, so then you just have to come up with some specific examples of potentials. And probably the best known example of a potential that can give you slow roll inflation are the class of models known as chaotic inflation, for which essentially the simple examples are where the potential takes the form of a power law. So the potential, say, has just one. Let's assume there's just one power. And n here is greater than or equal to 2, so it's either a mass term or something that's truly interacting. And the point is, with a potential of that form, it's going to be very simple to do this integral. So we have t minus t naught minus equals minus the integral from phi naught to phi of t square root of 3. Square root of the potential, so that's going to be square root lambda over n factorial phi. I'm going to put I'll keep it like that. Phi to the n over 2. And then on the bottom, we want the derivative. So that's going to be lambda phi n minus 1 over n minus 1 factorial, just differentiating the potential multiplied by m Planck. And now it's all integrated over phi. And so we just have a bunch of constants. Let's take those out. So we have a total root 3 lambda over n factorial, where you divide it by lambda, so you can put that on the bottom, multiplied by n minus 1 factorial, and then divided by m Planck. And then integral phi to the minus n over 2 to 1 minus n over 2 d phi from phi 0 to phi of t. And this integral obviously gives you phi 2 minus n over 2 divided by 2 minus n over 2. Now evaluated between those two points. And so rearranging somewhat, so that quantity can equal minus M Planck over n minus 1 factorial square root of lambda n factorial over 3 t minus t naught. I think I've got everything. So I can put that up over here, 2 minus n over 2. So that's your solution, basically, for the phi of t as a function of t. But you want to check what is the actual regime in which this thing satisfies the slow roll conditions. So if you remember, the slow roll conditions were basically m Planck squared. There was the epsilon one, which went like m Planck squared v comma phi over v squared. So that thing had to be much smaller than 1. So for this potential, this is going to be m Planck squared. So we're differentiating. And because we don't need to calculate the precise number of this, because it's just got to be a small quantity, so I don't need to worry about too much about the bringing the n down. So roughly speaking, we have lambda phi n minus 1 from differentiating. I'll ignore the n factorial because you're going to cancel on the top and the bottom, divided by lambda phi n. One of the things you learn about cosmology is that no one ever does things exactly. We always ignore factors and stuff like that. You get used to it. And then this is very simple. You just got one extra power of phi on the bottom. Now I'm looking at this formula that's... is my m Planck squared at the right place there? How's that got the right dimensions? Oh, no, it has. Yeah, sorry. Okay. So this basically goes... The lambdas cancel. You've got one phi in the bottom, so this basically goes like m Planck squared over phi squared. And so you require this quantity to be much smaller than 1. And this gives you a somewhat disturbing condition that phi has to be much bigger than m Planck. And that's pretty disturbing because, so essentially chaotic inflation, you can satisfy, it works very well, you can satisfy the slow roll conditions. But you seem to require values of the field which are bigger than m Planck. Did I do that right? Yeah, I did that right, yeah. And this is a problem when you actually try and construct realistic models of this form, is that you need to believe that you can trust your potential over field ranges which are bigger than m Planck, and in practice that's a very difficult thing to do. And so there's a whole story that people are still worrying about today. Even though this kind of potential has been around 30 years, people are still worrying about how explicitly to construct models of that kind. So coming from string theory, we had a talk on it yesterday in BI. It's a difficult thing to do. But nevertheless, it's quite a successful little model of inflation. So if you also do the other slow roll parameter, you don't get anything new, because the other slow roll parameter is basically proportional to m Planck squared v comma phi phi over v with a modulus sign. So the difference here now is you're taking the potential, differentiating it twice. So this thing is going to go like m Planck squared over phi squared. And again, you basically get the same condition. Yep.
So why is it bad that the field strength is greater than the Planck mass?
it's roughly speaking because... So when you couple field theory... So suppose you have a renormalizable field theory, like lambda phi to the 4, perturbatively renormalizable theory. The fact that it's perturbatively normalizable means you think you can make sense of it at arbitrary high energies. But the problem is, so let's just take lambda phi to the 4, which you've probably done in the field theory course, right? This is a nice theory when you're in flat space. But as soon as you couple this thing to gravity, which is exactly what you'd have if you were doing inflation with n equals 4 there, as soon as you couple this thing to gravity, this is no longer a normalizable theory because gravity itself is not renormalizable. And that non-renormalizability of gravity couples back into the scalar field itself. So in fact, we know in practice no theory is renormalizable because everything couples to gravity. Every realistic theory couples to gravity. And so any quantum field theory we write down that has any application to the real world is going to break down at some high energy scale. And that scale is exactly the scale with which gravity, the interactions of gravity are suppressed. And the strength of gravity, the interaction coupling constant of gravity is exactly 1 over m Planck. Now, the fact that gravity is non-renormalizable couples back into the scalar field and causes at the quantum level you to generate non-renormalizable operators such as things like phi to the 5 and phi to the 6 and so on. Things that wouldn't have been perturbatively normalizable in flat space. But because the interaction strength of gravity is 1 over m Planck, these operators get suppressed by powers of m Planck. So you have, so whenever you write down a theory, this is really the framework of effective field theory. Whenever you write down a theory, you'll have a sort of renormalizable part, a part that you can make sense of in flat space. But then from the very least, from the coupling from gravity, you'll expect to generate an infinite number of non-renormalizable operators that are suppressed by the Planck scale. And the problem now is that when phi hits m Planck, all these things are of the same order as this guy. And so the whole theory breaks down. And that's the problem. And there are ways around that, but not many ways. And it's quite hard to do. So this is sort of a generic constraint. When you couple any, you know, you can take your, this could be the standard model, which is perturbatively renormalizable, and you couple it to gravity, the standard model is no longer all you get. You're going to generate corrections to it which are non-renormalizable but suppressed by the Planck scale. And those are small for low-energy experiments, and that's why we don't need to worry about it, and that's why we pretend our renormalizability is a good thing. But in practice, what it does is it puts a fundamental bound that basically any field strength, any field of whatever appropriate dimensions it has. So the same goes for the electromagnetic field, say, that F mu nu, for example, the field strength has dimensions of mass squared. So if you couple electromagnetism to gravity, then electromagnetism will break down when the field strengths become an order of Planck scales squared. So there's a tension between the fact that it's very simple to achieve inflation. I can write down you lots of potentials that give you inflation that satisfy the slow roll conditions. But there's a tension with the fact that in general, actually, it's actually pretty difficult to achieve those in realistic theories. Which is why still today people are working very hard and trying to achieve that. So the last thing I'm going to say on this is that if you want to calculate the number of e-folds of inflation, which was in one of the problems at the end, so the number of e-folds, an e-fold is basically how much the log of the scale factor changes by. So we mean, let's suppose at the beginning of inflation, the value of the scale factor is a beginning, and at the end of inflation, it goes like it's of order e to the 75 times a beginning. Then essentially log a has changed by an amount 75, And so we say that there have been 75 e-folds. So the number of e-folds is simply a measure of the amount of expansion. The more e-folds, the more expansion you had during the inflationary epoch. And you calculate the number of e-folds, it's just going to be the integral. You take log a differentiated with respect to time and then integrated it over time from the beginning of inflation to the end. That obviously gives you the change. But we wrote it like that because log a dot is precisely a dot over a. Which is the Hubble constant, HDT. And the Hubble constant in the slow roll regime, at least, we can say the Hubble constant is 1 over square root of 3 m Planck, square root of v phi. That's the slow roll formula for the Hubble constant. And again, it's helpful to actually replace, instead of doing the integral over time, I could take the solution I have here for phi of t, plug it in there, and do the time integral. But it's actually nicer to write it directly in terms of an integral over phi, which you do like this. So you say h dt is actually h over phi dot d phi using the chain rule. You then use the formula for phi dot, is minus 1 over 3 h v comma phi. You plug that in. That gives you minus 3 integral h squared of a v comma phi d phi, where now the integral goes over from the value of phi at the beginning of inflation to the value of phi at the end. And then you just plug in the value of h. And the 3 cancels. That's nice. So then we have minus integral phi beginning, phi end, v of phi over m Planck squared, v comma phi, d phi. So we have a nice formula for the number of e-folds just directly as a function of the field value itself. Now, where you start inflation is anybody's business. You know, so it just depends on your initial condition. You've got some potential that looks like this. And you could start, you know, wherever you want. It's just something to do with initial conditions. I could start here, I could start there. But where you end inflation is unambiguous, because once you've started rolling down, you're going to keep inflating as long as the slow roll conditions are satisfied. So as long as the slow roll parameters are small, you will inflate. But as soon as either epsilon or eta hits 1, then those slow roll conditions are violated because we require them to be much less than 1. But typically during inflation, they're going to start increasing. As soon as they hit 1, the slow roll conditions have broken down, and that's when inflation ends. Now, the last problem in the problem sets, if you got to it, I think had something to that effect. So what the last thing I want to say about this is that if you look at these formula, to understand what's going on here, in both of these formulae, you've got V on the top and V on the bottom by the same number. So the overall scale of the potential is completely irrelevant to whether you can get inflation or not. It just cancels out. What is relevant, though, is the value of the field. So in some sense, V comma phi over V, in a very hand-wavy way, V comma phi over V scales, you always expect it to sort of scale like 1 over phi, which is exactly what you get for this power law solution. It's in a very hand-wavy way. You're just saying that V comma phi has an average one less value of phi than V does, so the thing scales like 1 over phi. So, and the same story is true for V comma phi over V. In most models, it's going to scale like 1 over phi squared. So the slow roll parameters, their conditions on the slope and the double derivative of the potential, but what's really relevant is actually the value of the field measured in units of the Planck scale. And that you see explicitly in this model, that the slow roll parameter really is 1 over the square of the value of the field measured in units of the Planck scale, so the field divided by the Planck scale. So making a bigger potential does not make it easier to get inflation. It's really to do with what the value of the field is itself. So now I'm going to switch. So are there any questions on that sort of review stuff before? No? Okay. Okie dokie. So so now to move on to where we're ultimately going to go, which is to understand how to generate those primordial fluctuations that that basically seed large-scale structure that explain how we exist. We're going to need some techniques, and the one technique we'll need to know is quantum field theory, now applied in curved space-time. And this is essentially one of those tools you're always going to need to know in early universe cosmology, because in cosmology, by definition, we're in a curved space-time because the space is expanding. And in the early universe, everything is going to be described by quantum field theory, because that's the right description of physics at high energies, which is valid in the early universe. Now, when you learn quantum mechanics, you're introduced to this idea of wave-particle duality at some point, a sort of wishy-washy notion that says, you know, that for every particle, like an electron, you can also, it has wave-like characteristics. And there are sometimes when the wave picture is most appropriate, there's sometimes when the particle picture is most appropriate. when you go to quantum field theory, in some sense, the waves win, because what you find out is that at a fundamental level, things are described by fields, which are waves, of course. The fundamental description is really fields, but these are quantum fields, and the quantized states of the field correspond to particles, and they can be single particle states or multi-particle states. So already when you go to quantum field theory, there's a slight sense in which, you know, fields win in the picture and particles have a slightly less significant role. When you go to quantum field theory in curved space-time, fields completely win. Only fields is the right answer, because there exist situations where there is no notion of particles at all. The particle concept completely breaks down. And this is one of the profound, well, it's probably the only profound thing about quantum field theory in curved space-time that makes it really different from the rest of quantum field theory. And when we learn it, we're sort of forced to change our attitudes about what was important about quantum field theory. So when, you know, often when we learn it, we think about particles scattering through Feynman diagrams. And that's a very useful picture in flat space, but in curved space-time, sometimes it just isn't the way to go, because the particle concept might have no meaning. And the rough, and so one example of how this works is, let's suppose we have some space-time which has a curvature scale dc. So that's the radius of curvature. So So then, you know, my best attempt to draw a curved spacetime on the board is something like that. And then DC is essentially the radius of curvature, and basically if you calculate the Riemann tensor on that spacetime, it would go like 1 over DC squared. So in particular, in a cosmological spacetime, DC is proportional to the Hubble constant, the inverse of the Hubble constant, I'm sorry. So it's what we call the Hubble radius of the Hubble horizon. So the rough picture of what happens, and this is essentially going to be the thing that you'll really need to know with regards to inflation, is that if you look at fields whose wavelengths are very small with respect to the curvature radius, so they oscillate many times here, for this field, it lives on something that it thinks is roughly a flat spacetime. There isn't much curvature over this regime. So if the wavelength is much smaller than DC, then it looks roughly like the field is on Minkowski spacetime, because it can't really see the curvature. And in that limit, because the field looks like it's on Minkowski spacetime, there is a well-defined notion of particles. Because one thing we do know is that on Minkowski spacetime, we can define particles as representations of the Poincaré group. But if you have a really long wavelength mode, something that oscillates with a wavelength which is actually bigger than the curvature scale, then you really know you're on a curved spacetime, and the Minkowski picture is completely inappropriate. And in this situation, there is no well-defined notion of particles. So the consequence of that is, so let me give you the cartoon picture of what happens during inflation, and basically we'll get to seeing how to calculate this later, but to give you a taster of where it's going to go, what happens during inflation the curvature scale DC is basically the Hubble horizon at that size. But by definition, inflation, if you have slow roll inflation at least, this thing is very approximately a constant. Or at least it changes very slowly in time. On the other hand, wavelengths, physical wavelengths, get stretched with the expansion with the scale factor. So physical wavelengths increase in size as the universe expands, just because photons get redshifted with the expansion. There's nothing to stop them getting redshifted. They have no internal forces to hold them back. So physical wavelengths get stretched. During inflation, you have this picture where you have some curvature scale and a wavelength which starts out very small. And so we really have a well-defined notion of particle for that wavelength. It gets stretched and stretched by the expansion until eventually it gets bigger than the size of the horizon. So then we say lambda increases until lambda is a point where it gets much bigger than minus one. The physical wavelength gets stretched beyond the horizon size. And then the notion of particles breaks down. We don't know how to count anymore. We don't know how to say we've got this many particles.
Can we say that we've got particles?
Pardon?
We don't know how to count them, but can we say that
we knew we had particles. Okay. Right, so we knew we start with 10 particles, say, in your state. But they get stretched outside, and we don't know how to count them anymore. I mean, no, there's an operator that counts 10, but the point is that, you know, physically you can't see 10 particles anymore. But then at the end, inflation ends, and the universe stops accelerating. The wavelengths continue to stretch, but so does the curvature scale. And the curvature scale at this point, curvature scale, which roughly speaking goes like h to the minus 1, this thing expands faster than the scale factor. So essentially one of the conditions necessary to have acceleration was that this thing expanded slower than the scale factor, but when you have deceleration, the curvature scale expands faster than the acceleration. So once inflation ends, you go into a decelerating universe. In a decelerating universe, the curvature scale expands faster than the scale factor itself. So at this point then, what happens is that all your mode was very big, it was well outside the horizon. The horizon itself starts, eventually gets to a point where the horizon size is much bigger than the physical wavelength again. Even though this is increased faster. And then you're back into the regime where you have a well-defined notion of particles. Okay, so we have a picture where we know we have 10 particles, say, and then we go to a phase where we don't know how many particles we've got, and then we come out and we have a well-defined notion of particles again, n particles. But now the crux of the matter is because we went through a regime where we didn't have any notion of particles, the number that comes out here doesn't have to be the same as the number that went in. And the punchline then is that you have particle, usually what happens is you have more particles than you started with, so you have particle creation. So the key feature, and this is really a key feature of time-dependent space-times, because this is a time-dependent process that I'm talking about, is quantum field theory on time-dependent space-times, which is exactly what you've got in cosmology, is the process of particle creation. In particular, even if you start with nothing, so you're really in vacuum, you have no particles, the vacuum will go through a regime in which you no longer know how to count your number of particles, then you'll come out, and your vacuum state just evolve forward in time through unitary evolution, will evolve into a state that's full of particles. And so this leads to, this is just an example of many conceptual issues that arise when dealing with quantum field theory in curved space-time. What does it even mean? What does the vacuum mean anymore? Because I've shown you that just by some relatively straightforward dynamics, you can take a state that had no particles, and then you can create particles. That's not the only issue. There are other things, there are other sort of weird things that you get, such as that different observers, so by that we mean observers who are on different space-time trajectories, so you might have one guy who thinks he's at rest, but then he sees another guy who's accelerating past him. So different observers, different people on different space-time trajectories, they will disagree on the number of particles they see. And a classic example of this is something called the Unruh effect. Has somebody mentioned the Unruh effect before? Might no? Okay. So something called the Unruh effect, which is a property that let's suppose you're in Minkowski space even. This is a weird one because even this one occurs in Minkowski space. Let's suppose you're in Minkowski space and you're an observer at rest. So this thing's supposed to represent time going this way, space going that way. So these are some Minkowski coordinates, and that's you just sat there at some fixed position. And you think you're in vacuum. But now let's suppose there's another guy who's accelerating past you. He's in the same state. Obviously, he's in there's only one state, and it doesn't matter. You don't define a state with respect to observer. There's only one actual state. But the accelerated guy, so he's got some acceleration A, he will see that same state, which is empty of particles here, he will see it as being filled with particles. In fact, he'll see it filled in a thermal way. So he'll see the number of particles of a given energy to scale in a Boltzmann-like way with some temperature, T, where beta, which is 1 over kT, is proportional to the acceleration. So there's an example where this is quite different from this effect. So this effect comes from there's actually some dynamics in the space-time that creates particles from the frame of reference of one observer. But here we see that one observer, in the same space-time, there's no dynamics at all, but you've got two different observers, one who's at rest and one who's accelerating, and one sees nothing, he thinks he's in vacuum, and the other guy sees a thermal distribution of particles. And the most famous example of an effect along these lines, which is very closely related to the Unruh effect, is of course Hawking radiation. And this essentially what the connection is that what happens is that in the space-time seen by an accelerated observer, he has an event horizon. There's parts of the space-time that he can't see by causality. And so essentially the bottom line is whenever you have event horizons, the vacuum state, the true lowest energy state of the system in some sense, is always ends up being filled with particles. And in fact, it's usually filled in a thermal way. So there's some profound connection between the existence of event horizons, be they cosmological event horizons, or be they black hole event horizons, and the presence of particles, in particular with a thermal spectrum. So what you see basically, as soon as you go to curved space-times, the notion of particles goes crazy. But at all these points, the notion of fields makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Are we actually going to go through and see this in detail using field, like
for the Hawking radiation?
Yeah.
You want to?
Or the Unruh effect or something like that.
So the Hawking radiation is a bit complicated. What do you think? Yeah, I could leave it as something we could come back to. The Unruh I'll do, because the Unruh is simple. Most immediately do, because it's the one of most relevant to inflation, is the fact that, you know, in de Sitter space, you also have an event horizon. And so in the sitter space, even in vacuum, an observer who is at rest will see a thermal spectrum of particles. And this, again, this is very closely connected with the Unruh effect. It's essentially, as soon as you have a horizon, you have a thermal spectrum of particles. Hawking radiation is slightly different because the difference there is in the de Sitter case, you're just filled with particles in all directions, but they're not going anywhere. You know, on average, there's as many coming this way as that way. The difference with the black hole case, so you have a black hole here, all the particles are radiating out from the black hole. And then, but you know, energy is still conserved there. So in fact, you're giving off energy. You know, there's some energy density which goes like the temperature to the fourth of those particles. You're giving off energy, so the black hole has to lose mass. So it gets a little bit smaller. Is that the right way around? Black holes are funny because they scale. So the mass scale, yes, mass scales with the size. That's right. But then there's a weird thing. So for a black hole, the mass scales with the size of the black hole. So the black hole does get smaller as it loses energy. But the temperature of the black hole is emitting at scales like 1 over the mass. So it's a very counterintuitive thing. The black hole gives out radiation and heats up. So then it starts giving out radiation faster, and it gets hotter and hotter, and so on. And so what happens is that for a long period of time, when the black hole is very big, like an astrophysical black hole, the temperature is so small that you know you don't see any Hawking radiation, which is why Hawking's never going to get a Nobel Prize, because they're never going to see it for a real black hole. But eventually, if the black hole wasn't taking stuff in, eventually it radiates down, and then in the final stages, the effect accelerates away and emits essentially all of its energy in a very short burst, because the temperature, which is going like 1 over the mass, as the mass gets smaller, as the temperature goes up, and this thing accelerates away, and you have this very quick evaporation. And this is relevant, say, for what you expect to see in the LHC, where it's possible to create very small black holes that are already on the point of evaporating away. And so you'll create them, and then they'll almost immediately evaporate away, if Hawking is right. And then you'll just see this burst of radiation. So that's one of the ways that people hope to see little black holes. So that makes it different from the de Sitter case, which is a case of most interest here. Because in de Sitter, the radiation isn't going anywhere. There's as much radiation coming this way as going that way. And so it's not radiating in any sense. So it's stable, whereas a black hole is unstable object. Okay. So that's the ideas. Was there anything else I wanted to say? So the point is that everything you learned about quantum field theory, learned from flat space, you have to readjust your notions when you go to curved space time, because even the very notion of vacuum is then becomes a somewhat dubious thing, because a vacuum is something that's filled with particles, so it becomes difficult to say what you really mean by that. So I've got about 10 minutes. So let me just remind you then. So tomorrow we'll get to the meat of it, but let me just remind you how you do quantum field theory in Minkowski spacetime. And we're going to see then how to generalize the rules to Friedman, Roberts, and Walk in spacetimes. So let's take some. So we'll work in the Heisenberg representation. In the Heisenberg representation, operators evolve in time that states are independent of time. Which differs from the Schrodinger representation, where operators are constant and states evolve in time. So in the Heisenberg representation, it's particularly simple Because essentially, you take the same equation you had for a classical field. Let's take some massive scalar field, for example. It's the same equation, except now all these things are operators. So the only new addition is that things, you're going to have an issue to do with commuting things. And there's going to be, this has to be, you have to tell me how things commute with each other, because they're operators, they're not just real numbers anymore. And the fundamental commutation relation is that phi at some time space value x commutes, or doesn't commute more precisely, with its momentum conjugate at the same time at a different value y. By a delta function x minus y. And this thing, pi, is the momentum conjugate dl d phi dot, which is just actually equal to phi dot. So in other words, the field and its velocity don't commute, just like for a particle now, but this is the field generalized statement. And that's basically it. That's all you need to know. You've got the dynamics encoded this in this action, and you've got the fundamental commutation relation there. So as long as you construct your operators in a way that satisfies that condition and satisfies these equations of motion coming from this action, then that's the definition of a quantum field theory. So I'm guessing this is all familiar, right? So I can speed through it. So the punchline of that, then, is that in flat space, you can decompose modes into you just find the most general solution of the field equations and decompose modes into solutions. So you can have positive frequency solutions with some coefficient ak, which is still an operator, of course. And because the field is real, or Hermitian, more precisely, you'll have negative frequency solutions, which I've written like that. And this is some normalization factor that we've put in for convenience, which is the energy of a given mode. And we know that to satisfy those commutation relations, we just need to have ak with ak dagger, ak prime, sorry, is equal to zero. So all these operators, which are the annihilation operators, commute. And ak dagger with ak dagger prime also commute, and then ak with a dagger k prime is 2 pi cubed delta 3 k minus k prime. And these are statements that are just derived directly from that relationship. So So again, I haven't said anything yet about the state. This is just all at the level of the fields, because we're in Heisenberg representation. I can ignore what's happening with the state until the very end when I actually compute a correlation function. And we want to be able to say we've got particles. We want to know how to count. So we have a number of there's a number operator, integral d3k, which you define like this. And the reason this counts is because it has particularly nice commutation relations with the annihilation operator. It just gives you, if you commute n with ak, it gives you back ak, which should be relatively obvious because the only thing it doesn't commute with is the dagger, and that picks you up a delta function, and then the integral goes away. And similarly with ak dagger with n, you have minus ak dagger. And this, you see this counts because let's suppose you've got some state n, which is an eigenstate of this operator with eigenvalue little n. So we take an eigenstate, and then we take that state and we apply the creation operator on it and compute n acting on that. And then the standard argument goes that n, use this commutation relation with a dagger, it picks you up. So we're going to use it this way around. So n a dagger is equal to a dagger n plus a dagger. So we have a dagger n plus a dagger acting on n. And then this n operator acting on n gives you the eigenvalue n. And so it goes like n plus 1, a dagger k, n. And so that justifies the notion that this is a creation operator. It creates one particle because it increases the value of this number operator by 1. So that's all standard stuff. But now, the thing we're going to need to know when we go to the curved space-time case is that there's not a unique way to represent these relationships. In fact, there's a whole family of operators you can define which are linearly related to the A's and A daggers. So let me write it this way around. So AK is AK K prime integral D3 K prime over 2 cubed. So that's alpha K K prime BK plus beta K K prime. So BK prime dagger. So let's define that particular linear combination where these things now are really just numbers. And similarly, AK dagger then is just going to be the conjugate of that. So because the alphas and betas are just numbers, we just take the complex conjugate. So it turns out there is a choice of the alphas and betas you can make such that when you plug these relations into here, and you infer what relations you need on the B's for that to be true, that the B's satisfy exactly the same relations. So that B and B dagger, B and B, B of K and B K prime commute, B K dagger, B K prime dagger commute, and B K, B dagger K prime is 2 pi cubed delta 3. K minus K prime. Now, is how many of you have seen how that works? Have you done it in any?
This is only in curved space-time.
Pardon?
This is only in curved
space-time. No, I'm still in flat space-time here. You've done that. In which? You did it. Did you do it in QFT?
What, just playing with the computation relations?
Yeah. Maybe didn't do the change of arrow. So does the so the relations on the alphas and betas that you get by demanding this is true. So I haven't got time to work it out now. So I'll just give you the answer. Is basically you require that D3 K1 D3 K2 on 2 pi cubed. So you have alpha K K1 alpha star K prime K2 minus beta K k1, beta star, k prime, k2, this thing has to be a delta function. So for example, that's one relationship. Does that look familiar to anyone? Yeah, that's right. So this is a Bogoliubov, or Bogoliubov, whatever you say it, transformation. Exactly. In the general case is a little bit complicated. All the relations. The simpler case that we'll almost always use in the cosmological context is where the alphas are themselves proportional to delta functions. And let me use an abusive notation and just call that alpha k. So both of these go like delta functions, beta k. And so then it's really we're just saying ak is alpha k, bk plus beta k, bk dagger, and the conjugate of that. And then the condition is that alpha k squared minus beta k squared is 1, as long as this condition is true, then the B's and A's satisfy the same commutation relations. So the point of all that is that associated with the B's, you can define a number operator just in the same way that you did for the A's. But the point is that this number operator is not equal to the A number operator. So the physical effect of doing a Bogoliubov transformation is to change your very notion of a particle, because it changes the one thing that we can do with particles is we can count them. They're supposed to be sort of discrete things, so there must be some discrete number operator that counts them. But there is some choice of representation or some choice of basis. Just the fact that we've got creation annihilation operators doesn't mean we have a well-defined notion of particles, because I can take linear combinations of the creation annihilation operators and construct another quantity which is also a number operator, which, because these satisfy the same commutation relations, has exactly the same properties. It can have integer eigenvalues that really count the number of particles. But this number operator doesn't equal that number operator. And what is more, they don't commute in general. So the physical effect of that is that, this is the one thing you sort of need to know, basically, in the curved spacetime case, because what it's essentially saying, there are different observers. So I told you that different observers see different numbers of particles, because every observer has a different notion of particle relative to another one, and so you get situations where one observer thinks he's in vacuum, so one observer thinks he's in an eigenstate of this operator with eigenvalue 0. So the vacuum, of course, is just defined as the state for which the eigenvalue is 0, so that annihilates it, and then we know the unique way to do that is to have it that all the annihilation operators acting on the vacuum give 0. But another observer, he defines particles with the B creation annihilation operators. In his vacuum is defined such that that is true. So that's A's definition of vacuum, and that's B's definition of vacuum. So it's also clearly true that the vacuum seen by some observer A and some observer B are not the same. And this is basically going to be the crux of the matter, that the reason you can have particle creation in a time-dependent space-time is that time evolution alone will create these coefficients. So it'll turn out that in the time-dependent case, these coefficients are actually forced upon you. So you have to end up doing some kind of Bogoliubov transformation where essentially alpha and beta are functions of time. And so you start out with something that you call the vacuum, but through the evolution, the time-dependent evolution of the universe, it will generate a Bogoliubov transformation and effectively change your notion of vacuum, which is equivalent to saying that you're creating particles. Because with respect to the new vacuum, you'll have a state which is filled with particles. And so, so we'll get to it tomorrow, hopefully, is basically how to calculate these quantities, which will now be functions of time. So in Minkowski space, you can do this transformation, but it's just that these things, you don't need to do it because, it would be a silly thing to do. But in curved space-time, the transformation is essentially forced on you by the dynamics of the system, and that's how particle creation occurs. So hopefully we'll get to that tomorrow.